So good to be with you all. Thank you for the way in which you've been welcoming Cammie and me these few days. We've experienced open heart, open minds. And when people gather with open minds and open hearts, all sorts of good things can happen. I'd like to begin with some words of awareness. In the gift of this new day, in the gift of the present moment, in the gift of time and eternity intertwined, let us be grateful. Let us be attentive. Let us be open to what has never happened before. In the gift of this new day, in the gift of the present moment, in the gift of time and eternity intertwined. So it's good to be here as a Celtic wandering teacher. And what we have done over the centuries as Celtic wandering teachers is to try to point simply to the sacredness of Earth and every life form, and to the sacredness at the heart of every human being. And coming back into relationship with that sacredness at the heart of all things is the way of transformation, I believe, and healing. Share with you some of the sort of essential insights of my new book, The Great Search, Turning to Earth and Soul in the Quest for Healing and Home. A new book always feels a bit like the birth of a new child. And this book had a long gestation period, and there was some hard pushing in the labor as well. But the great thing after a book has been born is that I get to carry it around and say, I'd like to share my baby with you. So I'd like to try to offer you the essence of this book, which I believe belongs to the essence of this moment in time, because we are living through an immense transition in the human journey, in the journey of Earth. And we're moving from a type of collapse of many systems of authority and religious belief and practice, and something new is trying to be born. And many people, of course, bemoan the collapse of authority systems and religion as we've known it. I think the most important thing to do at this moment is primarily to ask what's trying to be born, what's trying to come forth in a new way from within the human soul, and especially what is trying to come forth that will lead us back into true relationship with Earth and back into true relationship with one another as human beings and as nations and communities and religions. So that's the big story at the heart of this book. And that is the story that we'll be focusing on a bit today. But I'd also like to say that this big story, this time of transition, is reflected also in my own story. This is not a book about me, but it is important for me to say that I feel very much part of this big story, this time of transition. So my ordination as a minister of the church, I felt I could no longer hold together my sense of the sacredness of Earth and the sacredness at the heart of every human being with some of the foundational creeds and doctrines of Western Christianity, especially as those came into expression in the 4th century, when Christianity got into bed with empire and began to, in a sense, condone and bless what empire was doing. And of course, I'm not just speaking about the Roman Empire back in the 4th century. I'm speaking about the British Empire. I'm speaking about the American Empire. I'm speaking about any nation that has, in a sense, set itself up over the rest of humanity and is prepared to wrong or exploit, make use of other nations for its so-called well-being, and ignoring the profound truth that we will only be well together, and we will not be well by thinking we can only look after our nation or our people or our community or our species. So I relinquished my ordination, and recently on Iona, and it would be interesting for me to know, just a show of hands, how many of you have been on Iona? Great. Well, the rest of you need to come. And not all at once. It's a very small island. But we have these 4 annual pilgrimage weeks on Iona. And I unabashedly am an enthusiast for Iona pilgrimage because I have been changed in times on that island with other pilgrims, and I get to witness other people being very profoundly renewed and challenged. But during a recent Iona pilgrimage, a woman, one of the pilgrims, was asking me to speak a little bit about why I had relinquished my ordination. And when I finished, she said, "Ah, you gave back your ordination." And I think that's a better term than relinquishing, in a sense. It didn't fit anymore. I needed to give it back and be more free to try to speak from within this time of transition. Since giving back my ordination, I've become more aware of a tension that exists within our Judeo-Christian inheritance, and we find it right in the scriptures of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that is a tension between the temple, as it were, and the wilderness, or between the priestly and the prophetic. And I think these two need one another. So increasingly, I find myself speaking from the wilderness, as it were, calling for change. And I think what the prophetic voice has done over the centuries is to always denounce what is false or irrelevant or what needs to be changed. But it has not just been a voice of denouncing what is false or limited. It's also a voice that tries to announce a vision, a sense of the way forward. And the prophetic voice calling out from the wilderness, as it were, needs to and has always, in its truest form, it has spoken from love, a love for the family from which it has come, even though it's calling for profound change. So although I am in the wilderness, as it were, I continue to see myself as a grateful son of the Christian household. And from the wilderness, I am wanting to speak and serve love in relation to the family from which I have come. But what I do in the book is look at the great yearnings of soul at this moment in time. Because paying attention to the deep yearnings of the soul hold part of the key for the way forward, to get in touch with those profound yearnings of soul that are stirring in us. Simone Weil, the young Jewish woman and philosopher who managed to escape Paris just hours before the Nazi occupation of the capital of her homeland, but then died tragically before the end of the war. She speaks in one of her writings of the efficacy of desire, the efficacy of desire. And by that she's meaning that getting in touch with the deepest yearnings of the soul is efficacious. That is, it helps bring about what we are deeply longing for. It moves those stirrings from deep within up into greater consciousness. And from that place of greater clarity and consciousness, we can more readily translate those desires into action. We can more readily embody what we are deeply yearning for. So the nine chapters of this book are looking at the great nine yearnings of the human soul today. And in relation to each of those yearnings, I draw on a prophetic voice, prophetic voices from different parts of the world, from different religious traditions, from different spiritual perspectives. But all of them are inviting us back into true relationship with the sacredness of earth and the sacred depths of every human being. So chapter one is entitled Seeking Vision, or Yearning for Vision. And this is about looking for the sacred way beyond the bounds of what of the boundaries that religion has often tried to place on sacredness. It is yearning for a way of seeing that enables us to see that everything in the universe, since its flaring forth 13.7 billion years ago, everything in the universe is essentially both spiritual and physical. Everything that has come into being is like a manifestation of the divine. The prophet that I draw from in chapter one is Thomas Berry, who was a theologian, but he preferred to call himself a geologian. Such was his love of earth and sense of the sacredness of earth being at the very heart of his vision. Thomas Berry calls us to be in touch with what he calls three sacred texts. One, he says, is the text of the universe, or the text of earth, the text of the cosmos, to see everything as an expression of the divine. And he sees this as our primary text of revelation of the divine. And humanity was consulting this text of earth and the heavens long before religion came into being, and long before any written scriptures were formed. So he's calling us back to a primary source of revelation, to see earth again as our first and primary source of revealing what is divine. In tandem with that great text, that great living text, and nearly every great discipline of thought and study at the moment is pointing us to learn again from earth. But the second text that he refers to is the written text within our scripture, within our religious traditions. And one of the reasons he points us to the written text of scripture is because that is often where the prophetic voice of our religions has been documented or has been written down and expressed, that prophetic call to identify with the powerless, to bring our spiritual energies to serve those who are hungry, those who are homeless, those who are seeking shelter and sanctuary in our nations, to serve the life forms of earth that are being wronged and without power. So that's the second text, the text of written scripture that he invites us to be in touch with and to be reading. The third text, he says, is the inner text. It's the text of the human soul. And particularly in the human soul, he is inviting us to access imagination and the dreams of the human soul. Thomas Berry says, the universe is so amazing, it must have been dreamt into being. And then he goes on to say, and we are in such a mess, politically, religiously, ecologically, we are in such a mess that we need to dream the way forward. We need to allow ourselves to imagine ways of being, ways of seeing, ways of interrelating that we've known nothing of in the past. And this moment in time is a moment that is calling for that sort of deep imagining, deep dreaming of a new way of being. Because our political systems, our religious systems, our cultural systems have been inadequate to prevent us from where the human journey is at the moment. And the journey of self-destruction that leads us to question whether there will be a future for humanity if we do not come back into true relationship with Earth's sacredness and the sacredness of every human being. So that's chapter one. Thanks, Brad. They've been working me so ruthlessly here. So chapter two is called Seeking Earth. And the prophetic voice that I draw from in chapter two is Nan Shepherd, a Scottish poet. I like to slip in these Scottish prophets. So many of you may not be aware of Nan, but she was a poet and novelist. She now appears on the Scottish £5 note, the first woman writer to appear on Scottish money. And she's being celebrated by ecologists, by feminists, by spiritual teachers. And this would have really surprised her because when she died, she was hardly known at all. But I've chosen Nan to speak of our yearning for Earth, our seeking to be in true relationship with Earth. She wrote a very beautiful a book called The Living Mountain. She was in love with the Cairngorm Mountains at the heart of Scotland, and she allows this love affair with the mountain to be a metaphor of she calls us into that intimacy of loving Earth. When she's speaking about the mountain, for instance, one of the things she says is, no one knows the mountain, truly, who has not slept with it. And she sees her relationship with the mountain and our relationship with Earth as being like that of a lover who adores and cherishes the body of her beloved. So it's that sort of intimacy of knowing Earth again that she invites us into. And she realizes in her own journey that it is as she gets to know Earth's soul that she more deeply comes into contact with her soul. So this profound holding together of the soul of humanity with the soul of Earth, rather than the dualism and the division between humanity's soul and Earth's soul that has characterized so much of our Western world as well as our Western religion. Chapter three is called Seeking Presence, and this is about looking for the presence of the divine, not just in particular places, particular moments, particular people, but being alert to looking for the divine presence at the heart of every moment, at the heart of every person, in every place. And much more important than me speaking about this, I would like you to experience this quite briefly. Now, this could terrify some of you introverts, and it could totally delight you extroverts, okay? But I'm just talking about for a couple of seconds. Look into the eyes of someone next to you. Okay, you extroverts, come on back. This is the light of the eternal. The prophet that I draw from in this chapter is Martin Buber, the great Jewish teacher, who says that the world is like a burning bush. And this light of the eternal shines from deep within. And that's what we were glimpsing something of in one another's eyes, this light of the eternal that comes forth from within. And we are being invited, Martin Buber says, to know that in everyone we meet, in every life form, we are being invited to look for what he calls the eternal thou, and to know that we are bearers of the eternal thou, even in the way we look at one another, in the way we listen, in the way we speak, in the way we interrelate. So setting free this eternal vow that is already at the heart of all life. We don't have to invoke a foreign presence, a transcendent energy. We're being invited to set free this presence of the divine that is radically imminent at the heart of all life. Chapter 4 is called Seeking Awareness, and the prophet that I draw from is Carl Jung, the founder of analytical psychology. One of the things Carl Jung says is that the worst sin of humanity is lack of awareness or lack of consciousness. And part of his brilliance of prophetic insight is to see that awareness is not just from the conscious realm, which he says is like the tip of an iceberg. Most of what we are is very deep within the unconscious, that which isn't yet known, but waiting to come up. So he's inviting us to become aware, not only through our reason and through our mind, but through intuition and through attentiveness to our dreams and through feeling. And it is accessing these deeper realms of our being that we can grow in awareness of what he calls the soul of earth and the soul of humanity. Chapter 5 is called Seeking Wellness. And the prophetic figure that I draw from in chapter 5 is the 13th century mystic Julian of Norwich. So many of us, of course, know her statement of hope, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. These are sometimes quoted as sort of naive optimism on Julian's part. But let's remember who she was and when she was living. She was living through the worst pandemic that humanity has ever experienced. Within a two-year period in Europe, at that point in the 13th century, half the population of Europe died. So this is not naive optimism on her part. And very deep in her vision is the awareness that wellness will come in relation to the whole, not just in relation to the part. So all will be well. And that is when we will be well. So I can't claim to be well, truly well, if you are not well. I can't claim wellness for my family if the family down the road is not being provided for in health and education and dignity. We can't claim to be well as a nation if other nations are suffering. And we can certainly not claim to be well, and we are more and more understanding this. We cannot claim to be well and to have a future as a human species if Earth's other life forms are suffering. So her vision is to see that the wellness of the part and the wellness of the whole belong inseparably together. And she is inviting us to bring the deepest energies of our being to serve not just the wellness of any part, but to work for the wellness of the whole. Chapter 6 is called Seeking Love, And of course, the prophet that I draw from in chapter 6 is Rumi, the 13th century mystic, who speaks of himself as a type of lunatic of love. And he invites us into what he calls love madness, because this is our deepest energy. And he's not just speaking about romantic love, he certainly includes that, but he's speaking also of love of creatures, love of life forms, love of friends, love of family, love of self. And he is inviting us to know that we need to strip our religions and strip our spiritual traditions of anything that is not serving love. Love, he says, is the true religion. What he calls the love inside all love is the resurrection place. That's the place of new beginnings. It is our place of greatest energy for healing and change. Chapter 7 is called Seeking Wisdom, and the prophet is Rabindranath Tagore from India. Tagore is inviting us not to access some wisdom that is outside of us or that has been dispensed from above, but to access the wisdom of our soul. And he knows that the wisdom of the East and the wisdom of the West are given to dance together. They're given to make love. They're given to make one, to be made one. So part of the journey into wisdom is to be attentive to how the East has expressed this unitive wisdom of reality. And when we truly access wisdom, he says, we will become dreamers of dreams. We will access wisdom to help us imagine and dream the way forward. Chapter 8 is Seeking Meaning, and the prophetic voice that I draw from in chapter 8 is Etty Hillesum, who, as a young Jewish woman, began to keep a diary in the Netherlands after the Nazi occupation of her land. And she ends up in a concentration camp and eventually is murdered by the Nazis at Auschwitz. One of the most extraordinary things about Etty Hillesum is that in her diaries, the most repeated phrase, it's almost like a mantra in her writings, is to say that life is beautiful and life is meaningful. In the midst of the ugliness and horror of what she was witnessing and experiencing, she was accessing this deeper place. And she invites us to, the way she puts it is, we need to dig God out again. And by God, she's referring to that deepest part of her being. Not only her being, but she sees it as deep within every human being, even in those who were horribly oppressing her people. Chapter 9, the final chapter, is called Seeking Faith. And this is not about faith in propositional statements about God, which is how our religious traditions have often understood faith. The poet that I draw from in chapter 9 is another Scottish poet, Edwin Muir. And he comes to see that faith is not about believing certain propositional statements about the divine. Faith he sees as being faithful to what he calls the immortal shining that is deep in all things, something of which we were seeing in one another's eyes, something of which we can be looking for in the countenance of every creature, in the shining of every life form. And for him, seeking faith and finding faith again is about returning in part to the child's way of seeing and realizing, as he so beautifully describes in his autobiography, growing up on the islands of the Orkneys in the north of Scotland, he describes the child's way of seeing as seeing a light-filled universe. And he's inviting us to be faithful to that immortal shining in all things. I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs from the conclusion to the book before Cami leads us into a meditation. By the time I got to the conclusion, I sort of had a sense of what I was wanting to say, so that's that's why I'd like to read a few paragraphs from the conclusion. Religion, as we have known it in the Western world, is dying. We are in a time of transition, not only religiously, but politically and ecologically. What is the spiritual vision at the heart of our religious inheritance that we have forgotten or neglected? The Spirit is urging us to remember that we are to do to others, including Earth and every species, what we would most want done to ourselves. This is the teaching of Jesus at the heart of our Christian inheritance, with its equivalent in the golden rule of nearly every great spiritual tradition in the world. And this is the teaching that will guide us into new beginnings. In our great search of today, we are searching for what will bring healing, not only for ourselves, whether as individuals or nations or races, but for all people and for every species. And it is for all things that we are seeking a deeper sense of home address, both physically and spiritually. We are longing for a truer sense of shared origin and spiritual kinship with everything that has being, including a sense of family responsibility for one another. The vision of love at the heart of our religious inheritance can inspire us in our searching, but our searching must never be confined by the boundaries and limitations of our religions. During this time of transition, many of us, as we have been emphasizing, are in religious exile, whether that be literally as fugitives from our religious tradition of the past, or simply as dissatisfied members of it longing for more depth and vision. This time of spiritual exile in the Western world is a moment in which we are being invited to find relationship with Earth and one another in ways that surpass anything we have known. It is a time of opening to the Spirit in our own depths and the depths of every human being and life form. And it can be a time of liberation from the closed boundaries of nationhood or race or religion that have confined us in the past and separated us from one another. We are being invited to remember what we at some level have always known, which is that our true spiritual center is not Rome, for instance, or Jerusalem, or Mecca, or any of the other places that religion has claimed to hold special authority over us. Our true spiritual center is Earth and the human soul. Outward places of religious authority and significance may have played an important role in our faith traditions over the centuries, but essentially they exist to serve Earth and the human soul, not the other way around. The source of truth is deep within each one of us and deep within everything that has being. Just as new science enables us to know that physically we live in an omnicentric universe, so it is spiritually. The center is everywhere. Our cherished places of religious authority from the past, including our local churches or temples or mosques, can serve us in this moment of transition, but only if they remember that the center of the divine is everywhere, deep in my soul and your soul and deep in Earth's soul. We are longing for an expanded vision of the universe, a reawakened love affair with Earth, and a deepened sense of spiritual presence in every moment and encounter of life. We are yearning to grow in awareness, to find wellness in relation to the whole, and to delight in love together. And we are longing for the recovery of wisdom, for meaning in both the joys and sorrows of life, and for a reimagined faith in the immortal light that shines in all things. These are the yearnings of the Great Search today. If we are true to them, we will be blessed with the graces of healing, both individually and collectively. And we will be graced too with a new sense of home spiritually in our relationship with Earth and one another. It is this that will bless us and our planet in our shared journey toward wholeness. And it is this that will bless those still to be born, our children and our children's children. This is the great search that we are invited to be part of, turning to earth and soul in the quest for healing and home. So be it.